Okay, well, this is where the real lecture starts. Sorry for that little technical interregnum. So this is me. I'm from York University in Toronto, Canada, which you should know is also a rather left-leaning university. It's probably the most radical university in North America. I understand the present location is similar in some respects, or at least was. And I'm here for a year as a visiting professor at the University of Helsinki. Yeah, just to tell you that this lecture and the PowerPoint will be posted on this website. If you want to follow it up, you don't have to take detailed notes because it will all be on there. So here's the title of the lecture, Global Organic Crisis and the Postmodern Prince. And the outline is I will try and briefly explain what I mean by these two concepts. Then I'll look at the central object of much of the attention today, which is the global crisis of accumulation. And I will connect that to a wider concept of global organic crisis. And then I'll look at some of the political alternatives that are presenting themselves in the global situation now and articulate the significance of new forms of political agency. And I've used the term the postmodern prince to try to capture some of these forces. So if you read this quotation, it's from the Prison Notebooks by Gramsci. It's translated into English in the following way. The old is dying and the new is being born. And in the interregnum, there are many morbid symptoms. It was a sentence he wrote while incarcerated by Mussolini's fascists to describe the civilizational crisis that was occurring in the 1930s and in the Italian context, which was met by the rise of fascism. It was a kind of impasse which fascism responded to, an impasse in terms of a balance between social forces and the morbid symptoms that Gramsci anticipated resulted in World War II and a cataclysmic global struggle which was the most lethal in history. I've taken this concept and tried to rethink it and apply it to our present conjuncture. So the origin of the concept is in Gramsci. He used it in a specific sense, and he linked it to the contradictions involved in the development of political parties, and a particular aspect of the crisis in which he called the immaturity of the left forces in response to the crisis and in response to fascism, specifically in Italy. What I mean by this global organic crisis is something that Gramsci would have understood but wasn't able to perceive at that time. The combination of these political, economic, and social convulsions, which are also articulated increasingly with an ecological set of crises and challenges, which are truly global in nature. And they manifest themselves in a variety of ways in the present conjuncture. So in that sense, what I'm arguing is that the present crisis, if we think about it in a deeper sense, is much more fundamental than an economic depression or a recession or a cyclical crisis associated with the patterns of capitalist accumulation or economic growth. Conventional explanations being crises of overproduction and underconsumption on the one hand, or crises associated with the instability of liberalized financial capitalism on the other hand. We can talk about those issues in discussion, but that's not what I'm going to focus principally upon. And the crisis involves contestation and challenges to the dominant paradigm of social development in this global formation, which I call a neoliberal market civilization, which I've alluded to in the pictorial introduction. What about the postmodern prince? This is more of a potential than an actualization of collective political agency, but it is something in formation. And it's a concept that I've taken from Gramsci's reading of Machiavelli and their concepts of political agency. And it's an attempt to try and capture some elements of global progressive politics in the early 21st century. That's the image of the centaur, half human, half beast. And it's connected to the way that Machiavelli was thinking about the political and the creation of new forms of political possibility in the Italy of his time. The main concrete historical problem he was trying to think through was the way that Italy was divided and was subordinated to the geopolitical power of integral states such as France and Spain. The other thing about the way he spoke to that problematic, both in the Prince and in the discourses, was that it was essentially not simply a monarchical proposition, that the Prince should lead Italy to a new unity, but it was also implicitly a republican hypothesis. Machiavelli was trying to demystify the power relations at the time and speak to not just the people in the palace, the palazzo, but also to the people in the piazza, and explain to them the mechanisms of rule, and in so doing, demystifying relations of power. It's a kind of progressive, kind of critical approach to the question. One of the arguments of Machiavelli was that political power required both force and persuasion, or coercion and consent. There were two sides to political power, but if they were linked to virtue and a forward-looking concept, a new and unified Italian state would be less corrupt and potentially, and of course it's anachronistic to put it this way, more progressive than its predecessors. So that's the way Gramsci read Machiavelli. And it's my reading of Gramsci's reading of Machiavelli that, of course, you're hearing. So Gramsci was the person that coined the phrase the modern prince in the prison notebooks. The modern prince was a political party. And that political party was a vehicle through which, not the sole vehicle, but a vehicle through which workers could create a new hegemony, which would involve an ethical and democratic form of state and culture. And this, for Gramsci, was the solution to the problem of fascism and the 1930s organic crisis, which had given rise to fascism. Gramsci defined the modern prince as follows. The modern prince, the myth prince, cannot be a real person, a concrete individual. It can only be an organism, a complex element of society in which a collective will, which has already been recognized and has to some extent asserted itself in action, begins to take concrete form. And there's the reference to the quotation. So the modern prince is not an individual. It's not embodied in the individual leader. It's a collective organism. The postmodern prince, as I try to articulate it, is something that must be understood in that Gramscian heritage, but is something which, in a sense, is combining the old and the radically new, in a search for a new type of globally progressive hegemony. It's still in development. It's embryonic, but it has to be understood in terms of the long heritage of progressive politics that goes back centuries. It's a response to the global organic crisis, and it's embodied in certain organizations, such as the World Social Forum or the various left forums, but not only in those organizations. In a sense, it goes beyond traditional left politics. It isn't a kind of something that's led by elite vanguards in a Leninist sense. And it's not premised entirely on the primacy of industrial workers. It's more diverse in terms of its sources of the political and the social forces it reflects. And it's non-hierarchical. Gramsci thought about political parties in terms of what he called the theory of fixed proportions between leaders and intermediate strategy and mass membership. But what I have in mind is something that's more fluid and less hierarchical, with a diverse leadership, which, of course, is less amenable to being incarcerated, as Gramsci was, or decapitated. And in a sense, it has new political myths associated with the present conjuncture. I think some of those myths are reflected in what I've written down here, a myth of social and ecological sustainability, diversity, democracy, and equality of peoples, understood as a kind of universal project. So I think we need to look beyond the crisis of accumulation in order to construct new kinds of left politics, and the forces I'm describing are doing that. So to do that, I think we need to identify some of the elements of this global organic crisis in a kind of analytical sense. So let me quickly get to the orthodox view as it's represented by what I would call the discredited paradigm of neoliberal political economy, which has largely been responsible for governing many economic policies. This is a very good source. It's been very, very widely circulated, and you can follow it up on the internet. The view is that the slump of the last 2 years is similar to the Great Depression, and in some respects it's worse in relative terms. World production has fallen, and in many locations it's still falling. Unemployment is rising worldwide. World stock markets have plunged. World trade has fallen. But yet some of the orthodox commentaries are identifying that the green shoots have arrived, the corner has been turned, there has been an Obama rally. That should be Dow 10,000. The Dow Jones index has reached 10,000, not 1,000. That would have really been a depression for the stock markets. And there are concerns whether this is kind of a double dip recession. So in other words, the conventional gauges of output and economic activity are being used, and they're swamping the media coverage of the crisis of accumulation. The orthodox response has been as follows. Capital comes first. As soon as the stock markets began to plunge and the dislocations to capital seemed to be clear, most of the major governments in the world rallied to produce gigantic promises of enormous bailout and stimulus funds. One estimate is that the total committed in the transatlantic countries was about $17 trillion. By contrast, the Millennium Development Goals, which are minimal promises, the pledges were come to $750 billion. So we have to ask about the ethics of these priorities. So $17 trillion is the more or less the amounts committed, not all of which have been spent, but the bulk have been spent on the bailouts of capital. It's 22 times the total planned funds for the Millennium Development Goals, which are to provide minimum basic health and education for billions of the world's poorest people. Those are the planned funds. They're not the committed funds. The actual amount of funds that have been given is considerably lower than that. So the strategy has been billions for the banks and pennies for the people on the whole, if you look at it from a worldwide perspective. So in the quotation at the beginning, Gramsci referred to morbid symptoms. There are many of them, but I think one of the morbid symptoms in the present conjuncture is the articulation of this global crisis and rising hunger. And the Financial Times, which of course is one of the great organs of capitalist analysis and opinion, produced an editorial that contained the following in April. Almost unnoticed behind the economic crisis, a combination of lower growth, rising unemployment, and falling remittances, together with persistently high food prices, has pushed the number of chronically hungry above 1 billion for the first time. Now, it's worth remembering that the capitalism produces both obesity as well as starvation in the patterns of distribution that go with the world food system. And that's reflected in the fact that half of the world's population suffers from malnourishment, 25% are overfed. And this is particularly clear in North America, where there is an epidemic of obesity caused by very unhealthy sugar-saturated foods and a variety of other things connected to fast food culture. And the 25% of the world's population are underfed, or in the case that I mentioned earlier, are actually starving. So what specifically have caused these problems? Well, there has been an enormous spike in world food prices. This is from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and you can see how since 2000, global food prices have risen quite considerably, with a huge spike in price levels over the last 2 years and subsequently falling, but to a much higher level than was the case in 2000. More broadly speaking, this goes with the restructuring of global agriculture. It's coincided with increasing corporate control of global agriculture, which itself has been linked to a broader characteristic of the present conjuncture, which is the increasing turnover time of capital. Agricultural production has been linked to new methods of production to bring goods to market and to have food channeled through bodies more quickly, at least through affluent bodies more quickly. It's been linked to these new methods of production, which are very energy and fertilizer intensive. Third world countries have shifted to much more export orientation towards the world market, with a side effect that there has been a shift towards more crop monocultures and damage to the biosphere. And there has been a decline in local self-sufficiency, with the result that the world market now determines what is called food security by the World Bank and the international financial institutions. So food security, redefined by the world market, is reflected in this diagram, where the world market arbitrates through prices whether people can afford to eat or not. And if you live on $1 or $2 a day and the price of your basic foodstuffs virtually triple, it's not surprising that you cannot purchase the food that you need to eat. There are some proximate causal factors of this conjuncture. The period of the 1990s was a period of liberalization in the world economy and partial liberalization in agriculture. Agriculture is less liberalized, of course, in the European Union and in North America than it is in many other parts of the world. The U.S. Did push for more liberalization and at the same time massively subsidized its own farmers. Enormous subsidies go to American farmers, and particularly to very large farmers and corporations, and that allowed them to dump their export surpluses massively on the world market in the 1990s. The effect of this was to wipe out many small third world producers. And a very good example of this, which Marx would have called, would have linked to mechanisms of primitive accumulation, was the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994, which required Mexico to liberalize its agriculture. The U.S. didn't actually reciprocate, which allowed American exports to flood into Mexico, and that wiped out the livelihoods of over a million Mexicans in small farms. That happened in different ways in different parts of the world. The food crisis has been described by The Economist as a perfect storm, as if it was the result of natural disasters. And of course, natural forces are important, such as climate change the degradation of soils. But the principal causes of the price increases are man-made. They're human-induced causes. One of the key things, and probably the most important cause of the spike in oil prices, was a shift by the United States to encourage the production of grains for biofuels in response to U.S. energy security concerns, U.S. Problems in securing sufficient oil for its industrial and transportation systems. Perhaps two-thirds of the spike in oil prices is connected to that shift alone, because of the gigantic role that American production plays in determining world food prices. And the other reason seems to be speculation in food markets, especially on the Chicago and New York commodity exchanges, where expectations of future price rises have a kind of multiplied effect on prices. I used the term food security a little bit earlier to describe the way that the World Bank sees this problem. But there is an alternative conception which grassroots groups use, which is the concept of food sovereignty. It's a response to this disturbing fact that one in seven people in the world is starving, and the price rises that I've been describing are creating huge dislocations as well as provoking riots worldwide. Grassroots groups that are part of this greater set of forces that I've been describing, such as Via Campesina, the landless workers movement in Brazil, and other grassroots people's organizations, are pressing for what they call food sovereignty, which they don't mean national sovereignty or sovereignty in the traditional international relations sense. They mean that the people are sovereign at the local level and can produce their own food in ecologically sustainable, organic ways, so that they can subsist in a sustainable way and also have new methods of production in ways that can connect to the building of a new type of society. So cultural, political, ecological, and agricultural concepts are combined by these forces, and they are pushing for changes locally and from below and transnationally, because Via Campesina is a transnational set of organizations of agricultural producers. And this has prompted a lot of third world governments to rethink many of their agricultural policies in support of that kind of initiative, to support small-scale farmers and women who do most of the agricultural labor in the world, to do so in ways that are ecologically sensitive. And this has also pressured the G20 to try and come up with meaningful funds to deal with this. And today the Gates Foundation announced that it was going to put money into this. The G20 and the Gates Foundation are seeking to respond to the global food crisis through sustaining the world market mechanisms, which I personally think are part of the root cause of the problem. But at least they're responding as a result of the politicization of the issue. So this is simply an example, it's a devastating example of the concept of organic crisis. It shows the way in which there is a link between the crisis of accumulation and the new patterns of accumulation associated with the development of neoliberal capitalism, and the real threats to the everyday survival and livelihood of people as they seek to find a way forward in their everyday lives in the poorest situations. It also shows how it's connected to people in richer countries, such as the United States. It's very difficult to get healthy food in the United States. The food is laced with sugar and salts. It's creating all kinds of problems of disease. And a whole industry has grown up to respond to these health threats. Capital sees an opportunity in the danger that's being posed by the food chain and the system of food production in the United States to the health of ordinary people. This is what I mean about these linkages. Nevertheless, I think we should step back historically from these immediate issues and ask, well, what are the differences between that situation in the 1930s that Gramsci was describing and today? Well, the first is that the crisis of accumulation, it really is global. In a sense, it's almost heralding a second Great Depression on a world scale, because it's worth remembering that in the 1930s, the Soviet Union was outside of world capitalism. And after the Chinese Revolution, an enormous proportion of the world's population was also removed from the world market of capitalism. Now there is an integrated world market which encompasses most of the globe. Secondly, the G8 responses reveal that they've understood some of the macroeconomic problems associated with the instabilities of capitalist cycles of accumulation. They understood something of Keynes, but they've also shown themselves very clearly to be one-sidedly favorable to big capital, and very specifically to financial capital, and what I call the plutocracy, that is a class of super-rich people who have been enriched over the last 15 or 20 years. The third issue is that the dominance of the plutocracy and big capital is not opposed by really existing and convincing communist alternatives in the way that was the case to a certain degree in the 1930s. So neoliberal forces are still in command of the terrain to determine public policies and the response. However, and this is what Gramsci would have called the optimism of the intelligence as opposed to the pessimism of the will of the previous points I've made, there are some signs that there are some new forms of left-wing political agency which are emerging, and I've been alluding to them in this lecture. And I call these, collectively, in their diversity, the post-modern prince. So let me just list some of the defining elements of this. It would take several lectures to go through them in detail, but I'll list them for you, and you can consider them, and perhaps we can discuss some of them. The first thing is that, I referred to this briefly earlier, that in order to maximize profits, which is really the be-all and end-all of capital, one of the mechanisms for increasing profit is to increase the turnover time of capital. So if you look, for example, in agriculture, there are new breeding mechanisms that breed new generations of animals that fatten more quickly. Cattle are developed in feedlots, so they bulk out more quickly. They produce more milk more rapidly. They use hormones and various other chemicals to control the conditions of the production of these meats, and then they are brought to market very quickly. They're sold in fast food restaurants and so on. This is partly how the turnover time of capital is connected to the increasing rates of exploitation of nature, but also of people. People work longer hours and more intensively in many parts of the world. And again, the United States is a very good example of this, and that's why people need fast food. In many respects, we could say that we can generalize that states are now more subordinated to capital than was the case between the 1930s and the 1960s and 70s. It's a generalization, and like all generalizations, it could be contradicted. But generally speaking, we've seen a convergence of the purposes of state policies in the last 25 or 30 years in support of intensifying the disciplines of capital. And one mechanism for that is a consistent policy to allow profits to be privatized and for the risks of capital, especially for big capital, to be socialized. The huge bailouts is one example. The costs of externalities such as pollution is another. The public bears the costs of pollution rather than capitalist producers in most cases. And the other side of this is that the risk is privatized for the weaker and less well-represented members of society, and their everyday risks are privatized. And feminists call this called the broad set of provisions connected to the nurturing of families, the development of education, as well as the development of the labor force, the institutions of social reproduction, including the reproduction of the species. And there has been a shift away from state support for these things on a worldwide basis. So risks become more naked for individuals and are consistently socialized for big capital. So the political power of free enterprise and the property is fully restored. So we have this unprecedented growth of a global plutocracy. It's quite astounding how wealth has become concentrated, and I'll give you a few indications of that shortly. So this is the broader picture, is that there has been an acceleration of extreme inequality of income, wealth, and life chances. An image here. This was the distribution of world gross domestic product in 1990, according to the Human Development Report of the UN. It's called the champagne glass distribution, and I think it's a telling image. The richest 20% of the world's population at that time had 82% of the world's income, and the poorest had just 1.4%. So the glass is rather full for the rich. And since that time, this glass would have been even more full at the top, because there has been an intensification, but I couldn't find a more recent diagram of this. But I think it shows that an income distribution at this point in history, which is rather similar to the 1920s, the so-called Gilded Age of capitalism. The Financial Times read a report by the UN, and it asked, without reading Marx's Capital, how could you possibly explain this kind of income distribution? How the richest 2% of the world now owned more than 50% of the world's assets. This is productive wealth, not just income flows. In fact, if you read that report in more detail, you will see that it's even more concentrated than the Financial Times believed. This is the ownership of the means of production. The bottom 50%, half the world's population, collectively own less than 1% of total wealth. This is a study that was carried out from Helsinki by the UN. So part of this is the expropriation or dispossession of producers of their means to subsistence. There are many examples of this going on simultaneously in the world. Marx originally called this primitive accumulation. The dispossession of the indigenous peoples in the Amazon is a good case in point, not just of their land, but also, in some cases, their DNA, their tissue, as well as their knowledge. China is another good case in point. It's called the new enclosures because it harks back to the dispossession of the peasantry and the producers on the land when capitalist agriculture emerged, initially in Europe, but throughout, initially in England, but also throughout Europe several hundred years ago. And it creates the freedom of the labor market, the freedom of the producers now dispossessed of their land to sell their labor in labor markets. That was a central argument of Marx in Capital. Other elements which connect to the notion of legitimacy and legitimate authority. President Obama just received the Nobel Peace Prize, which may have puzzled many people. But I think it was a response to some of the actions of his predecessor and the administration of George Bush II, who seemed to specialize in the arbitrary use of coercion and military force and the suspension of the rule of law. And the use of force with impunity as a kind of regulative principle of world affairs, raising big questions about the ethical, political leadership of the dominant nation on Earth in its quest for world peace. So the next issue, and it connects to many of the things I've just said, there is a growing set of contradictions between legality and legitimacy. The bailouts are all legal. The massive transfer of funds to capital is legal, but is it legitimate? And it's provoking challenges to ask about new questions about the future of global governance and the importance and meaning of international organizations and democracy at the global level. And at the same time, and I want to keep emphasizing this, all of this is occurring as market civilization of the type I'm describing in the United States, based upon suburban lifestyles, huge houses, energy-intensive development, consumerism, waste, is spreading, creating threats to the biosphere and the ecology of livelihoods. So all of these are elements of this global crisis. So we'll come to the conclusion. So what are the main political alternatives that are presenting themselves in response to this situation? Well, the first thing to remember is that we are still in a kind of de facto state of emergency. It began in 9/11 with the Bush response to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But we are living in a slightly different form of the state of emergency now. It's an economic state of emergency. So the norms and principles associated with, as it were, normalcy are up for grabs. Let's assume that this state of emergency comes to an end and there is some stabilization of the capitalist economy. Obama seems to represent an effort to stabilize with some Keynesian elements, but it's very clear that his program is very conservative. It's one-sidedly favoring Wall Street. The discussion right now is about exit strategies. This is a code phrase for the reintroduction of mechanisms to bring government budgets and government debts into manageable proportions as a result of the huge costs of the bailouts. And it's being linked to debates amongst the leadership of the world about how to introduce mechanisms that will justify and lock in a return to fiscal discipline. That would be higher taxes for the majority of people, austerity, greater privatization to help pay for government debts, and further cuts in provisions for social reproduction. The other thing would be, and it's already occurring, would be increased market discipline on individuals, workers, and families. There have already been greater pay cuts in the last 2 years than have ever occurred in modern capitalism since the Great Depression, forced on workers. Workers are indebted. They have lower incomes. And of course, in many cases, their pensions have been wiped out. So the IMF becomes important, particularly for poorer countries, and that includes countries in Eastern Europe. And it will likely impose, and is imposing, on the recipients of its loans, further conditionality and stabilization programs, which are likely to include the above. The other thing that's worth noting is that the bailouts and the stimulus measures may not work, and they may not stabilize the situation. Some of the reasons are that because macroeconomic policy is in unknown territory, effective interest rates are zero, not just in Japan, as they have been for almost 15 years, but also in the US and the UK. There is still a big debate about who will pay for the costs of these deficits. If these efforts to manage the crisis and stabilize the situation fail, it may reinforce tendencies towards a more reactionary and authoritarian capitalism. Clearly not exactly the same as in the 1930s, but in perhaps a new form. And it's worth remembering the effects of the first state of emergency that I referred to, which is that there has been a strengthening of government surveillance mechanisms and apparatuses of repression as a result of the war on terror. And this could be used in extreme situations. Now, what about in the global south? Well, the organic crisis has been there and has been clearly there for many, many years. It could be traced back hundreds of years, but certainly it can be traced back to the debt crises of the 1980s, where a particular kind of external imperialist set of institutions came to control public policies and shifted many third world countries towards neoliberalism under the so-called Washington Consensus. There have been innumerable riots and protests throughout the third world over a variety of things, mainly over neoliberal policies, but including issues such as the repression of trade unions. And political leaders. But the Western media seems to give these very little coverage. So the public tends to be unconscious of these forces in many parts of the world. But I think we can expect more contestation, particularly in those countries who will be under the tutelage of the IMF or the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development as their sovereignty is impinged by these externally imposed neoliberal conditions and austerity measures. There have been other responses in the global south, and I call these state capitalist responses, and they take two different sets of forms, crudely speaking. There are rising third world powers such as China, Brazil, and India, each of which are very different, of course, but their general stance seems to be to create alliances and some alternative geopolitical frameworks to give them more leverage vis-a-vis the traditional G8 countries, and to challenge the dominance of the US and perhaps the US dollar. But most of their activities at the state level on the part of their governments have been very much within the existing frameworks and definitions of global governance, which are still, of course, configured by institutional frameworks that are designed to sustain neoliberal global capitalism. In other parts of the Third World, this is particularly the case in Latin America, there are more progressive, socially progressive state responses. Venezuela and Bolivia are two good examples. They've tried to come together on a regional basis to create alternatives to, particularly to Yankee imperialism in Latin America. What about progressive movements? Well, I think the progressive movements should perhaps continue to assert that the present crisis is more than a crisis of capitalist accumulation. It can't be simply corrected by these stimulus and bailout measures to stabilize the situation. It involves a state of global economic emergency, which has opened up the discourse and contestation about capitalism, but it could also lead to reactionary outcomes. And that the crisis involves the contradictions of what I've called this market civilization, this consumerist, privatized, energy-intensive, ecologically myopic pattern of social development. So the crisis is social and ecological. And I think the postmodern prince in the multiple involves the global lefts. I've used lefts in the plural on purpose, because they are combining and must combine to address the global organic crisis, which affects, of course, are felt very unevenly and unequally throughout the world. Within the context of these forces and movements are what Gramsci called organic intellectuals. He associated organic intellectuals with both the bourgeoisie, so people like Benedetto Croce was an organic intellectual of both the Italian bourgeoisie and Italian fascism, as well as the organic intellectuals of the left in the progressive political parties, the Communist Party in particular. I can see, if I look around the world now, that progressive organic intellectuals are not necessarily in traditional political parties or traditionally organized political forces, although some of them are. There are millions of them. They are in all walks of life. They are teachers. They are librarians. They are doctors. They are people with technical expertise. They're ordinary workers who debate and think about these questions and think about them in a careful way and are seeking to imagine a different type of society, one that can go beyond the confines of a world governed by the disciplines and logic of capital. So these millions and millions of organic intellectuals, in a way, are developing a kind of new language of politics. And in a way, I think it's quite interesting because it involves a kind of a different type of left politics, a new kind of internationalism or globalism, which involves this social and ecological dimension, as well as the dimensions of production and social reproduction, and also questions of ethics and the meaning of what it is to be civilized, what type of civilization, or what multiplicity of civilization should be possible, as opposed to the monoculture of market civilization. So I thought about how Gramsci's question would be posed today, and sorry that this is a mouthful, but it's as follows. The old forces are dying, but are not yet dead, and new forms of political agency are still being born, but in the interregnum, the organic crisis with its morbid symptoms is intensifying. Thank you. Can we take a few comments from if people would like to do that, rather than just one question at a time? Can I just spell it out for you? www. www.stephengill.com. My name. So I had a little trouble following your points because you spoke a lot, but you also spoke a little quietly for me to hear. But my assumption in your question is that you're asking me what alternative do these rising countries offer, and secondly, how does that link to Africa's claims for compensation for the costs of climate change? And finally, what is world capitalism? Let me deal last with the question about what kind of political agency or subject can and what form it could take, how that would go forward, because that was the last part of my lecture, and I can recapitulate and elaborate a little bit on that. There were two questions about that. The other questions were different. They were about different things, but let me just take the first one, which is rather, in a sense is rather empirical, but in a way is part of the clue to some of the solutions that are needed. The person at the back asked about rising oil prices. The general conjuncture which I've been describing seems to coincide with what has been called peak oil. In other words, the general consensus seems to be that, and it was backed up by a very sophisticated report commissioned by the German government, that the world has just about reached the maximum extraction of fossil fuels that is possible from the earth. And nevertheless, the growth of countries like India and China, on top of the patterns of growth that we already see in North America, Western Europe, and many other parts of the world, means that that is not a sustainable situation. It means that prices will continue to go up in the long term. Right now, because of the global recession, prices have fallen a little bit, but we're likely to have a very expensive energy regime vis-a-vis fossil fuels. So I entirely agree with the thrust of your question, which I think pointed towards the need for a different type of solution to the nature of our infrastructures, the way that energy is used in our societies, and how that connects to lifestyles. When I made the points about this phrase that I use about particularly North America, but you can see it developing even in places like China and India amongst relatively affluent members of those societies, people want to have not just one car, they want to have two cars, they want to have a bigger house. They want to be able to have the illusion of freedom that comes from bigger highways and suburbanization. And that is an unsustainable and illogical way to deal with all of the problems that we're facing. And we need to have much more investment in clean production of energy, a shift away from the automobile, a shift away from agriculture that relies on oil-based products for fertilizers because they're damaging to the ecosphere, they're poisonous to human beings, and to move towards better public transportation, to create living spaces and cities which are accessible to people. You know, you try and think, the two cities I've been in Finland are Helsinki and Tampere, so I haven't traveled very much in this country, but I've traveled a lot in North America. And in most North American countries, the only way you can get around in a city is through a private automobile. So older people, for example, who have mobility problems, have no means of being able to get around and navigate things. And it's a very wasteful way for a civilization to be physically structured. So I think in a sense, the warning about oil prices should be a signal to more and more people that that these changes are needed. The impact of those rising oil prices, incidentally, will be very unequally distributed. Richer people can pay more. Poorer people can't. So it intensifies many of the problems of inequality that I was referring to earlier. So I think that there is also a link between the food prices and the oil prices, because many of the fertilizers and systems of transportation that connect the world food structures are mediated through oil. A good example I usually give is if you buy your food in a typical supermarket in North America, before that your fresh tomatoes or fruit has reached the supermarket, it's already traveled 1,500 to 2,500 kilometers by road in refrigerated trucks. So it's really at the expense of these local systems of provisioning, which we could all return to and have better food. Actually, Finland is very, very progressive in the way in which food is regulated. I think it's one of the best places in the world. You actually can get decent food which is not laced with chemicals and hasn't been grown in necessarily in that kind of productive system. So I can only echo your point. Rising countries like Russia and China, well, if they were actually developing in ways that that went against the grain of this pattern of market civilization, then I would be more hopeful for the future. There are some signs in China that China is seeking to develop wind power and various other non-polluting and non-fossil fuel type energy systems. But you know, the phrase that's often used is that China is becoming the Great Mall of China, not the Great Wall, the Great Shopping Mall of China, because of you know, people are beginning to behave like Western consumers, and the government is going to reorient consumption in China, production in China for domestic consumption. So that may actually accelerate the development of market civilization in China. Similar patterns, I think, can be observed in Russia. So if their leadership embodied alternative conceptions of the future, I'd be more optimistic. Of course, the Chinese government tries to say that it's a communist government that is presiding over capitalism right now in order to move to a transition to socialism. I hope that that's the case, because China is going to become more and more important in the future. Should Africa be compensated for climate change? Yes, I mean, there has to be a global and collective solution for this. And, you know, Africa has been pillaged not simply for its ecological resources, but for its human resources. You know, there's a very strong case for African countries receiving reparations for slavery. That, the very beginning of my pictorial representation showed Africans being transported across the Atlantic in slave ships. What is society? And it's not the same as the state. Society and the state are interrelated. In different countries, that interrelationship takes different forms. What is the governing model for the relationship between state and society currently is what I would call the neoliberal model. The neoliberal model is based upon a liberal conception of constitutionalism, in which there is a separation between what liberals would call state and civil society. In a liberal constitutional order of the type that we have in North America, in Western Europe under the European Union, the state is ultimately separate from and in many respects subordinated to the interests of civil society. And the main mechanism for that subordination was identified by Marx in Capital many, many years ago. It was also identified by other sociologists in the 19th century, such as Max Weber. That institution is the institution of private property. Private property means that the property which adheres to an individual is not subject to control or expropriation by the state or by other forces. The unfortunate thing, of course, is that private property involves not only our homes and our personal belongings, which are our private property and should be our private property. It also means that the basic means of production and many of the institutions of social reproduction can be privately owned. And if they are privately owned, it means that the state, in a constitutional order which is liberal, cannot intervene to tell somebody what they should do with their private property. Private property can mean, if I own all of this land, you cannot go on my land. I can spoil this land. I can do what I want with it. And the state, in a liberal political order, cannot prevent me from doing so, because a liberal political order is constitutionally required to protect private property. And one of the things that's been happening in this neoliberal era, and it would be the topic of an entirely different lecture, has been the spread of liberal constitutional orders to countries such as the Soviet Union and the constituent countries of the Soviet Union and the countries of Eastern Europe. As Eastern European countries become part of the European Union, the conditions of entry into the European Union is that they have to change their constitutional structures and structures of government in order to protect private property rights. So states and societies relate to each other in different ways. But in a capitalist social order, ultimately, society is configured in such a way so that its predominant institutions are governed by the rights of private property, and the state is secondary to the and guarantees those rights. So I think it's very important to bear that in mind. It's an absolutely fundamental aspect of the political constitution of world capitalism. Now, the last set of questions were about whether we should name a revolutionary subject. Well, I just did. I called it the postmodern prince. I don't have any problems with naming a subject. I could also call it world progressive forces. But nobody has the right to name anything other than for, as it were, conceptual or theoretical purposes. Only the millions and millions of people associated with those movements have the right to decide what they should be named as. And as I think your question pointed out, there is a division on strategy amongst the millions of organic intellectuals and organizations that the other person raised. Some people believe that a unified, singular form of political agency organized in the form of a political party is precisely connected to many of the problems that the organized left has had over the last 40 or 50 years. And it's connected to the fear on the part of many of those organizations that you would have an authoritarian, centralized form of leadership which would begin to arrogate the right to speak for the constituent power of the people. In other words, the constituent power would not be the people, it would be some kind of vanguard sovereign that would represent itself as being the voice of the people. And there are others that have a more of a kind of post-structuralist formulation of a left-wing project, which is that it should be a diversity of many different projects. I think that it has to be a bit of both, really, because clearly a centralized form of political agency right now is something that cannot be born. And you can see it in the debates at the World Social Forum. A lot of the debates are around that issue. But it will be the members of the World Social Forum and of these many other organizations that will give the answer to that question, not a theorist like myself. I can make suggestions. So how can the millions of organic intellectuals come to constitute a cohesive political force? Well, I think only if they rethink the language of politics to allow for this diversity and multiplicity to be part of the project, and to incorporate innovations from people who are not university professors in North America. Some of the most imaginative political thinking comes from the leaders of grassroots organizations in Latin America, for example. If you look at a person like Rigoberto Menchú, she has a very sophisticated critique of capitalism, which is harnessed to a long-term view of stewardship and ecological sustainability. And many of the leaders of the workers' movements in Latin America, for example, are very austere. They're young people who, many are not known in the West, but they have very, very powerful political imaginations, and their credibility is very high because they really do exert ethical and moral leadership. And there has to be more communication and connection amongst all of those people so that what it provides an exemplar of that type of innovation and progress can be shared with other people, as well as finding ways to make these connections more permanent across and between people. But I think it's a different kind of political moment that we're in. The other thing I would say is that my own view of this postmodern prince and where we're at and the organic crisis is that the formation of these left forces has lagged behind the depth of the crisis. And it may take many years before there is a political subject in the multiple that is more coherent in the sense that I'm talking about. And it may be too late, because one of the aspects of the global organic crisis is climate change, and many of the experts, scientific experts, are saying that unless we do something significant to deal with the oil-based economy and the energy problems that the first question raised, and deal with the climate change issue, we only have 10 years to do it. So there may be a disjuncture between the actual time frame that's needed for radical innovations in politics and the threats that we face, because if we return to disciplinary neoliberalism, it will intensify market civilization and the global organic crisis. So I think we're at a point in history where that choice is very stark. Okay, I think the answer to your first question is ethnicity and religion would be part of the solution in the sense that it is a source of tolerance and a source of appreciation for the suffering of others. In other words, certain readings of Catholicism are progressive readings, although on the whole, the Catholic Church has tended to be a repressive institution. There is no reason why an interdenominational tolerance would not be part of the progressive movements and could be sustained partly as a result of the progressive movements. Huntington's Clash of Civilizations is a text that I think is basically it's an attempt to use culture and civilizations through the geopolitical lens of the Cold War. It's the West versus the rest. It's a very simple and dichotomous view of civilization. Civilizations are very differentiated patterns of social and cultural life, and they are elements in movement. Many of the elements of market civilization you can find across civilizations, for example, and there are many examples of inter-civilizational exchange. They're not as singular and as impermeable as Huntington's proposition would give lie to, and I think that any kind of future that was premised upon that conception of civilization would be very dangerous and would deepen the crisis that we're in. The other point you made, problems between men and women. Throughout my entire narrative, I used the phrase social reproduction, which comes from feminist political economy. And it's a phrase that recognizes the differences between men and women, not just in the production of everyday life, but in the basic social institutions that make communities and civilizations possible. And men and women play interrelated but have very different roles. I did say at one point in my lecture that most of the work in the world is carried out by women, particularly agricultural work in the third world. And I think that any coherent and progressive future has to be based upon institutions that guarantee equality between men and women and the equal participation of men and women in the determination of their futures. That would go up against the grain of certain religious doctrines. So there would be a limit to how far and under what conditions certain types of religious propositions could be tolerated. So I think it opens up a lot of questions. They're big questions. But that would be a start of how I would discuss them. Final point, world organizations. World organizations are not homogenous. Probably the most homogenous world organization is the International Monetary Fund, which is doctrinaire, neoliberal, involves a very narrow remit of economic theorizing and application. Whereas UN institutions are very varied. They include quite progressive organizations, including, for example, UN organizations that are connected to the development of the rights and resources for women and women's equality, for example. The UN system is very varied, but it's completely underfunded, as you correctly say. The major reason why it's underfunded is because the US will not pay its share of the dues. But they are not simply tools of the plutocracy. In a sense, what they are, they're tools for stabilization of some of the dysfunctions of world society, for mediation of some of the propensity to violence in world society, and in a sense for legitimating some of the changes in world society. So they necessarily have to involve some progressive elements to incorporate opposition and to show that there is some legitimacy to world institutions. The World Bank is also very diverse, but is much more neoliberal than some of the more progressive aspects of the UN system. So should we rely simply on social movements and civil society? Not simply on them, of course. No. Many social movements are reactionary. We should ally with progressive and forward-looking and tolerant social movements, but connect them to concrete institutional initiatives and try to change laws at the national and local level, as well as looking at global institutions. Global institutions tend to be the least democratic of all institutions, apart from certain aspects of local government. So I think the strategy has to be a global strategy, and it has to be wide-ranging. It has to be based upon a multiplicity of possibilities and connections, and it has to be able to deal with immediate questions and immediate challenges, as well as look to the future and hope that a better future can be created for future generations.